We continue our study this morning about 12 who dared. We're talking about the 12 apostles. And yet when we talk about them, as much as they're mentioned in the Gospels particularly, we have to admit we actually know very little about most of them. When we hear their names, Simon Peter, Andrew, James and John, sons of Zebedee, Philip, Bartholomew, Thomas, Matthew, James the son of Alphaeus, Thaddeus, Simon Zelotes, and Judas Iscariot, of those, only Simon Peter, John, James, and Matthew do we even feel like we know anything at all. And maybe Judas, and that's only because we know he was the one that betrayed Jesus and eventually killed himself. But the vast majority of the things we would like to know about any of these men, we don't know. That's such an amazing thing, because the scriptures actually say that the whole church is built upon the foundation of the apostles. And while the early church acknowledged these men as the ones through whom they had heard the gospel, I think they actually, the early church that is, represented the same mindset that Jesus himself had, in that these men were not greater than other men. And as a result, it was not until much later that a much more institutionalized church, the Roman church, finally sort of sanctified them and called them Saint Peter and Saint John and so forth. But the early church didn't think of them that way and did not try to preserve for us today a great deal of information about them. Just the work they did. That's what was important. But there are some things we can know about them as we look today. And most of what we can know about them early on is not very flattering. And it might even raise the question for us, why did Jesus choose them? There certainly were probably other men in the Jewish nation who were much more intelligent than these men were, who were much more spiritually perceptive than these men were. Perhaps even some, like Nicodemus, who were much more willing to believe that Jesus was the Messiah even early on than these men were. It's in John chapter 3, Nicodemus is already saying, we know you're from God. And it will be over halfway through Jesus' ministry in Matthew 16 before Peter will finally say, we know you're the Son of God. Why these men? Now, we don't know exactly the answer to that, but we can at least know some things about them and perceive something about the way Jesus was going about his ministry as their rabbi and they as his disciples. And in seeing that, it should tell us a lot more about how he sees us as well. Of course, as I read the scriptures and use my resources, I have gathered over the years around me some resources I found particularly helpful in the study of the 12 apostles. And one of them is a book called 12 Ordinary Men, written by John MacArthur. I've mentioned it before in connection with this study. And as MacArthur is talking about Jesus trying to train these men who were not untrainable, but difficult to train, he says this, all their shortcomings and human failings seem to overshadow their potential. Jesus' time was short. These men had already left whatever vocations they were experts in. They had abandoned their nets, forsaken their fields, and left the tax tables behind. They had relinquished everything they knew in order to be trained for something for which they had no natural aptitude. But when they forsook their jobs, they by no means became idle. And in this, what he's about to say is really the genius of Jesus. They became full-time students, learners, disciples. Now the next 18 months of their lives would be filled with even more intensive training. We might say the best seminary education ever. They had the example of Christ perpetually before them. They could listen to his teaching, ask him questions, watch how he dealt with people, and enjoy intimate fellowship with him in every kind of setting. He gave them ministry opportunities, instructing them and sending them out on special assignments. He graciously encouraged them, lovingly corrected them, and patiently instructed them. That is how the best learning always occurs. It isn't just information passed on. It's one life being invested in another. But Jesus was having to overcome some real shortcomings in these men. And that's what we want to talk about this morning. And that is, what were their weaknesses? While we may not know specifically many things about Bartholomew or Thaddeus, we may not even know how to spell those two names today. There are some things we can know in general about them because it's said about all of them. And the first thing that we want to notice about them, of four things this morning, the first thing is that they lacked spiritual understanding. Jesus, in Matthew chapter 15, after he had told a parable to the people, Peter asked in Matthew 15:15 to Jesus, "Explain the parable to us." And here's Jesus' first response. "Are you so dull?" Last night I gave Don my pocket knife for him to sharpen. He was busy sharpening another knife out of their kitchen knives. And so I took out my pocket knife and left it with him to sharpen because it is so dull. We have an old expression that's used in some parts of our country about he's not the sharpest knife in the drawer. But Jesus says to Peter, and I think really to all of them, "Are you so dull?" What he means is that they're not perceiving, understanding what he's saying. Again, in chapter 16, we see as they were crossing the lake together and he has said something to them about avoiding the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees, and they discuss this among themselves, and it's pretty clear the disciples don't understand what he means by it. And it says, aware of their discussion, verse 8, Jesus asked, "You of little faith, why are you talking among yourselves about having no bread? Do you still not understand?" You see, these men were the product of their culture. And while they were the one culture in that period of time that was the closest to God, because they were the descendants of Moses and Abraham, they were the Israelites. They were the ones that God had made the promises to, delivered the law to, and had protected and kept as they were a nation and then divided and goes into captivity, then brought back and protected and guided and all of those things. They were God's people. But they had been taught all of their lives from the time they were born up until Jesus called them to be his disciples. They had been taught some things and been influenced by some things that kept them from perceiving or understanding what Jesus was trying to tell them. They had a very prejudicial view towards all non-Jewish people, first of all. And when Jesus is trying to tell them that he's come for all people, that was hard for them to grasp because they were prejudiced against everyone who wasn't Jewish. They were prejudiced against the Samaritans. They were prejudiced against the Greeks, against the Romans, against anybody who wasn't Jewish. They had all sorts of false notions about things. If they saw someone who was blind, they would ask Jesus, "Was this man born blind because he sinned or because of his parents?" You know, and other kinds of ideas like that. Even though they were trying to grasp spiritual things, you know, when they were prejudiced against other people, it's because they thought they were God's people. When they saw someone who was suffering, they thought it was because of sin. That was an attempt to be spiritual. But it wasn't truly understanding things. Their conclusions about keeping the law of God, their religious leaders had misled them into sometimes putting a great emphasis on very minor parts of the law while ignoring some very major parts of it. Their ideas about the Messiah and what he was going to be, they had ended up being taught all of their lives that only some of the prophecies about him going to be king, going to rule over the nations and set up his throne in Jerusalem, and they had missed all the others about making the blind see and the deaf hear and setting the captives free. They had missed all of that. Or it had probably been mentioned somewhere along the way, but it just wasn't ever a point of emphasis in their Saturday schools. Not Sunday schools, but Sabbath schools when they would go to synagogue. So as a result, they lacked spiritual understanding. On top of that, the example that had been set before them by the religious leaders, when we read in Matthew 23, "Woe to you scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites! Now, not all the religious people were hypocritical, but Jesus took to task some of the leading religious leaders and teachers for living such hypocritical lives. And he talks about how they would bind heavy burdens on the people and make great demands on them of keeping this and keeping that and keeping some other part of God's law and some of their traditions and so forth. And they wouldn't even do it themselves. And about them twisting the scriptures to their own advantage and things like this. So they had not only an incomplete spiritual education, they had very poor examples set in front of them. And as a result, it was very difficult for them to break through from that and see what Jesus was really trying to say to them. They were, we might say, slow to hear. Oh, they could hear what he was saying, but it wasn't translating into something that made sense to them and they could accept yet. They were being difficult to understand. He would, at various times, use words, either the exact words or the equivalent of saying they were thick-headed or they were dull or they were even stupid or blind. And he's not talking about his enemies, he's talking about his own disciples. Now, if that's the only thing we knew about Jesus' relationship to them, we'd think he would be highly frustrated and angry with them, and exactly the opposite is the case. He knew when he picked them that was what he was facing. That's what he was having to overcome. And so he patiently taught them, instructed them, corrected them, went over it again and again and again. And even after his resurrection, it looked like that they still hadn't quite gotten it. But we can see ultimately that he knew what he was doing. We pointed out perhaps last week or 2 weeks ago that later, after Jesus going back to heaven and they were once standing before the Sanhedrin, it says in our translations that the ruling council of the Jews took note of these men, that they were ignorant and unlearned men, but that they had been with Jesus. But in the Greek language, where it says ignorant and unlearned, it really says they were agrammatos. That literally meant they didn't know the letters of their alphabet. And unlearned is actually the Greek word from which our word idiot comes. Idiotis. They were agrammatos and idiotis. So from the educationally elite people in their own culture even, these men were seen as being not very educated, and yet Jesus educated them. So the first thing that was a fault in them, or a problem at least, that Jesus had to overcome is the fact that they were slow to understand what he was saying. That was very much shaped by the background they'd come out of, and that they were still surrounded by, that everyone around them was still involved in that false way of thinking about so many things. So they were slow to understand. Secondly, they lacked humility. That again was at least in part influenced by this background they came out of. How many different times did Jesus catch them talking among themselves about which one of them was going to be the greatest? They had this false idea about what he was about. And so then they had this idea that when he actually became king and ruled over everything, that he was going to start dispensing out political favors to those who were closest to him. Who's going to be his prime minister? Who's going to be his treasurer? Who's going to be the king, the general over his army, and all that sort of things. And they argued about those things among themselves. And that's how what they were arguing about when they were talking about who was going to be the greatest. They lacked humility. What was Jesus' solution to that? He set an example of humility before them. While he was their leader and their rabbi, and allowed them to call him master and teacher, nevertheless, he fed them, he washed their feet, he prayed for them, he looked out for them. When Peter's mother-in-law was sick, he went with him to his house and healed his mother-in-law. Jesus was a model of service, of humility. And he said to his disciples, not just the 12, but the greater number of disciples, "Come to me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart." And we never hear anyone accusing Jesus of being prideful or boastful or arrogant. Some of the things that we do see in some of his disciples. Number three, they lacked faith. That's expressed in the passage Don read to us at the beginning. As they've gotten onto that boat to cross the Galilee Lake in Matthew chapter 8, Jesus has fallen asleep in the boat. We have very much the rabbi-disciple kind of description going on, because it says, then he got into the boat and his disciples followed him. That was a typical rabbi-disciple way of doing things. They always waited for the rabbi to do something, then they followed. Without warning, a furious storm came up on the lake so that the waves swept over the boat, but Jesus was sleeping. And the disciples went and woke him, saying, Lord, save us, we're going to drown. And he replied, you of little faith, why are you so afraid? Then he got up and rebuked the winds and the waves, and it was completely calm. The men were amazed and asked, what kind of man is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him. This is one of five times I could find just in Matthew that Jesus said to his disciples, either you of little faith, or in at least one occasion, you of no faith. So Jesus had to struggle with his disciples for their lack of faith, their lack of belief, their lack of trust, their lack of confidence in what he had said and who he was. Now, at times it would sort of come out, but then it would retreat again. But it's not just in Matthew, Mark as well. We read the same kind of other events he records that aren't found in Matthew, or at least Jesus not rebuking them about it. And he says, do you still have no faith? Mark 4 and 40, and even after his resurrection in Mark 16. It says in verse 14 that later Jesus appeared to the 11 as they were eating, and he rebuked them for their lack of faith and their stubborn refusal to believe those who had seen him after he had risen. Luke also records in Luke 24 that the two who were walking down to the road to Emmaus on the day Jesus rose from the dead, Jesus joins himself with them, and as they're going along, they're talking to him about the things that had happened. They don't realize it's Jesus. But then his response to them in Luke 24:25 is, how foolish you are and how slow of heart to believe. It's not like these men had some real downsides. Slow to understand, full of pride and lacking in humility, full of doubt, questions, slow to believe. We know the story of Thomas after his resurrection. The first day of Jesus appears to them, Thomas wasn't with the other 10. And so all week long, they're busy trying to tell Thomas they had seen Jesus. And he says, I won't believe it unless I see him myself. And so the next time Jesus appears to them, Thomas is with them. And Thomas is one of the 12. And Jesus says, see? He's showing him not just himself, but even the nails marks, the wound in his side. And he urges Thomas to stop doubting, but now believe. So these men, you know, were not the most full of faith people you might could have found. Or maybe they were. Maybe that was the very best Jesus could do. How did he counteract their lack of faith? He continued to do the things that would build faith. For example, when they're in Matthew 8, whenever they, when he has to rebuke them for the lack of faith during the storm, he then shows his power over the storm. That was intended to build faith in them. Sometimes we think that Jesus' miracles was more to convince the unbelievers. It was. His disciples, the unbelievers. John himself says near the end of his gospel in John chapter 20, this is right after the event with Thomas. Jesus said in John 20:29, because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. And then at that point, John puts in this comment. Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. John is, first of all, saying all these things are written down so people who read them could believe in Jesus. But he's also saying, at least my understanding, sort of between the lines, he's saying, don't be like we were, who saw Jesus do these things and still were lacking in faith. He's urging his readers not to be like he and the other 11 were. Doubtful, not understanding. So they lacked spiritual understanding, they lacked humility, they lacked faith, they lacked one more thing. They lacked courage and commitment. Because of probably that lack of faith, they lacked commitment. In John chapter 6, after Jesus has fed the crowd of over 5,000 men, plus women and children, so it might well have been a crowd of over 10,000 or even 15,000 people, he fed with 5 loaves and a few fish. Then he starts trying to teach them about the real bread from heaven, the real bread of life, that God had sent him to be the real spiritual food that people needed. Yes, he can make physical food for people, but could they see him as a spiritual food that God had sent? And the response out of many of his disciples, it says in John 6:60, on hearing it, many of his disciples said, "This is a hard teaching. Who can accept it?" And aware that his disciples were grumbling about this, Jesus said to them, "Does this offend you? What if you see the Son of Man ascend to where he was before? The Spirit gives life. The flesh counts for nothing. The words I have spoken to you are spirit and they are life. Yet there are some of you who do not believe." And so he's still pointing out that some of them, you know, are lacking faith in him. And it says in verse 66, "From this time many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him." And then Jesus asked the 12, verse 67, "Do you want to leave too?" He's asking, where's their commitment? They had volunteered and had been invited to be his disciples, and he their rabbi. Do they want to leave now? Where's their commitment? It's at this point, actually, that Simon Peter says, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. We believe and know that you're the Holy One of God." And yet it will be some 2 years later in the garden that night, as Jesus has told them that later that night he's going to be arrested and tried and the next day crucified. He's already told them all that. They've gone to the garden, and while he prays, they sleep. And he comes back and says, "Couldn't you wait with me for just 1 hour?" And then when the soldiers come to arrest him, Peter first pulls out his little sword and wants to try to defend Jesus, actually hurts someone with it. But then after Jesus is actually taken into custody, they all run away, all of them. Not enough courage. They do follow him, two of them do, John and Peter, follow him to the place he's being questioned and tried, and John actually goes in because he has connections in the household of the high priest. So he actually goes in to where the proceedings are taking place. Peter stays outside in the courtyard, as we know, and during the night will 3 different times deny he even knows who Jesus is. Peter, every time makes a list of who the 12 apostles were, he's always mentioned first. Almost like, without getting into what the Roman church has done with him, it's like he almost was supposed to be number one. And yet number one is denying he even knows who Jesus is. And then he goes out and weeps bitterly at the crucifixion itself. The only one we know of for sure who was even there was John. All the others are hiding. These are his disciples. These are the 12, or the 11 at this point. Judas has already killed himself after betraying Jesus. And yet what did Jesus do to try to counteract this lack of commitment and courage on the part of these men? He prayed for them. He forgave them. After his resurrection, he actually meets with them up at the Lake Galilee and deals with this matter with Peter. And he says, "Peter, do you really love me?" John 21. "Then feed my sheep." And then he promises them, last thing before he leaves, he tells them, not only were they to go make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you. But then he said, "And look, I will be with you always." They weren't always with him, because they didn't have the courage early on. "But I'll always be with you." Isn't it interesting that by the time the Gospels close and the Acts opens, that they now have courage? And history will end up recording for us that they, every one, to devote their entire lives to spreading the good news about Jesus. And of the 11, 10 will die violent deaths as they try to spread that gospel. The 11th, John, will live to a ripe old age of 90-something, and at the very end of his life, be exiled on an island to keep him from preaching the gospel. Why did Jesus choose them? They seem to have too many negatives, too many things that would say they were not the ones he should have chosen. Their lack of spiritual understanding, their dullness of hearing, their lack of humility, their lack of faith, their slowness to come around to being courageous, committed men. Paul says in 2 Corinthians that God chose the weak things of this world to despise the strong. He chose the despised things of the world to overcome the esteemed. And he says in 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 9, of his own circumstances even, that the Lord told him that my strength is made complete in your weakness. Jesus actually chose men who needed him to be strong. It was only through him they gained understanding. It was only through him they gained humility. It was only through him they gained faith. And it was only through their belief in him they gained courage. So that they did not get the glory for what happened, God did. And in spite of these flaws and failings in their life, they dared. They dared to follow him. They were willing when others were not. And while they sometimes lack commitment, they at least were committed to being committed. They did not, even when they ran away, stay away. They came back. That probably describes us too. Sometimes we're pretty slow to understand. Sometimes we're a little too proud, lacking in humility, slow to believe, and lacking in commitment and courage, just like them. But he chose them and he chose us. He tells us that through his own strength, we will be made strong. And we can be all he's called us to be. We have an invitation song that challenges us to think about what Christ has done for us. And why our response to him not only has been, but is going to be all of our life. Because in individual moments, we may sometimes fall short. But over a lifetime, how do we live? How did they live? And does God get the glory for it? If there's any way any of us need to respond to the invitation, you can do it now while we stand up and sing the song.